This is an update from November 11th on Rojava, Syria, with Megan Baudet. You can get more information on this from defendrojava.org.
This is a very critical time in these political processes, so it's a great time to be able to give an update. Now, as you probably know, if you've been following the situation in the region, almost exactly 1 year ago, the Syrian regime was toppled by military operations led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, and affiliated armed groups. And just over 1 year ago, it was publicly announced that the Turkish government was engaged in renewed peace talks with Abdullah Öcalan, the founder and leader of the PKK, who's been imprisoned in Turkey since 1990. And we have, in that interceding year, reached a stage where these negotiations have progressed quite significantly politically, but at the same time have not fully borne out results on the ground. So this is a period in which actors on all sides are now looking at the changes that they are going to make. Now, if we start with Syria, during the operations against the former Syrian state, from the beginning of that military campaign, HTS and the Syrian Democratic Forces and the Democratic Autonomous Administration in the Northeast were in communication. These groups that, you know, led the campaign against Assad were clear that they did not seek active armed conflict with the Autonomous Administration and the SDF. However, other members of their military coalition, the Turkish-backed Syrian National Army, took the renewed conflict in Syria as an occasion to ethnically cleanse the Shahba region, which was home to many Syrian Kurds, including many IDPs from Afrin, which was invaded and occupied by Turkey in 2018, and to threaten to cross the Euphrates River at Manbij and attack Kobani, one of the core areas of the Autonomous Administration and the Rojava Revolution. Now, ultimately, due to some quick international diplomacy and a real lack of, I think, appetite for further civil war at the time, there was a ceasefire reached with international mediation between the SDF and nominally the Turkish-backed groups, in reality with Turkey itself. And that ceasefire has largely held up since it was achieved in December of last year, in significant part due to civil resistance by the population of northeast Syria at the Tishrin Dam, which is a strategic site along the Euphrates River where these militias were attempting to cross, where many people came and protested, you know, in support of the SDF and the Autonomous Administration for months on end. So since then, with a few, you know, small incidents, that ceasefire has held in place, and there's been no real change to the map of territorial control in Syria. Now, within the territory held by HTS, which quickly dissolved itself and formed the Syrian Transitional Government, you'll hear people refer to it as the STG, so that's what it is, the transitional government led by HTS. In the government's new territories, there was a very different picture, because while you had relative stability on the front lines with the SDF, and conditions in northeast Syria didn't really change and have actually improved because of the ceasefire with Turkey, in government-held territory, there were two violent military campaigns against ethnic and religious minorities. So in March, there were attacks against Alawite majority areas in the context of clashes between groups opposed to the new state and forces affiliated with HTS and the SNA, with these SNA militias being integrated into the new army. We saw reporting from Reuters that put a number of about 1,500 Alawite, mostly civilian casualties, and that suggested that these armed groups, you know, including Islamist groups, Turkish-backed militias, groups, you know, very closely affiliated with the state, did take part in that violence. And then later in the year, In July, there were clashes in the Druze region of Soueta in southern Syria. This region was already semi-autonomous, throughout much of the civil war. It regained much of that semi-autonomy, in the political transition. And this conflict was largely precipitated by government forces attempting to force their way in. Now, these two rounds of sectarian violence have been extremely damaging, for the Alawite and Druze communities and for the state-building project of the transitional government as a whole. Because while during this period of time, they've been embarking on a very successful, in many ways, campaign to gain international support, recognition, and investment, these bouts of sectarian violence show that they either do not control the behavior of their armed forces, or they believe that targeting ethnic and religious minorities is acceptable behavior for their armed forces. So this has really shaken a lot of confidence in the capability of the new state and shown that there are very real threats to the Kurdish communities and other ethnic and religious minority communities that live in the Northeast if there were to be, renewed conflict. So at the same time, in this very fragile situation, in order to really protect the political and social gains that have been made in Northeast Syria and to ensure that this type of violence does not repeat in the Northeast, the SDF and the Autonomous Administration have been engaging in diplomatic talks with the transitional government to find a way to peacefully reintegrate into the new state of Syria. In March, there was an agreement signed between the SDF and the transitional government that basically said, in effect, that the SDF and the Autonomous Administration would be integrated with the transitional government's institutions, and the new state of Syria would recognize the existence and rights of its Kurdish citizens. Now, in practice, the government almost immediately went back on that commitment, putting out a constitutional declaration that made no mention of Kurdish rights or existence at all, and actually repeated many Ba'athist-era policies of establishing only Arabic as an official language, naming the state itself as the Syrian Arab Republic, which erases not only the Kurdish population, but the many other non-Arab Syrian populations that have called Syria and that region home for centuries. So this immediately, shook a lot of people's confidence in this agreement. And then, of course, the ongoing sectarian violence further, I think, damaged that process. But it's important to note there have been no major attacks against Northeast Syria since the agreement was signed. And diplomatic engagements between the two parties have continued. And this is something that I think it's very important for people to understand. Damascus is not capable of waging war against Northeast Syria. It is not in their interests to do so when you look at what they're trying to get out of the international community. The instability it would create for them would negate a lot of the effort that they've been putting into attracting investment, trying to rebuild and consolidate their own power. So Northeast Syria has been able to establish itself as a political and military fact on the ground to a degree that it would be very damaging to both sides for conflict to break out. And I think that it's important that this be recognized. We're not in a situation where we're looking at imminent conflict beginning in this region. And so even with these, provocations and indications of, I think, chaos and a very sectarian attitude coming from the transitional government, negotiations have continued. And there was one incident of, brief clashes that actually, instead of escalating into further violence, seemed to remind negotiators and I think critically the international community of the urgency of getting to some type of deal. So about a month ago, in the beginning of October, clashes took place in the Sheikh Maksud neighborhood of Aleppo, which is a Kurdish neighborhood that's been held by the YPG and the YPJ since very early on in the civil war, and that survived siege and attacks from both the previous Syrian regime forces and from Syrian opposition forces that, you know, now make up the current regime of Syria, you know, that have taken over the Syrian state. So in early October, following road closures, blocking access to the neighborhood and blocking the, you know, transit of people, materials, there were civilian protests by local Kurdish residents, which armed forces affiliated with the transitional government attempted to violently disperse. And this escalated into a period of fighting between transitional government forces and the autonomous administration affiliated internal security forces. I forgot to mention, and it is important to mention, that one of the actual few diplomatic gains that followed the March 10th agreement was a specific agreement on the status of Sheikh Maksud in Aleppo specifically. So the YPG and YPJ left, the Asayish or internal security forces remained, they set up joint checkpoints with the traditional government, and they set up a roadmap for the neighborhood to maintain its institutions and build those institutions into the existing administration of the city. So there was an agreement in place here. And again, we saw that the transitional government, and in particular, the armed groups affiliated with Turkey that have been integrated into the new army, were not very serious about upholding their end of that agreement. And that led to conflict. But importantly, instead of escalating into the kind of large scale ethno-sectarian clashes that have otherwise stemmed from these kind of provocations in other parts of Syria, the fighting was over in less than 12 hours. Both sides quickly reached a ceasefire. And just the day after those clashes had taken place, there was an SDF Autonomous Administration delegation in Damascus meeting with the transitional government about the implementation of the March 10th integration deal. And I think that's very important because, again, this shows that the new state is not interested in picking a fight with the SDF and with the Northeast, even in the place where they are the weakest in Sheikh Maksud, where they control a neighborhood. They don't have the territory or resources that they have in the wider Northeast. So, again, I think that shows the degree to which, you know, they're is an understanding that the SDF and the autonomous administration cannot be dealt with as a security problem. And I think that that's very important. So since then, there's been some positive progress in the integration talks. We've heard from the SDF leadership that they've made agreements verbally in principle in the meetings to have the SDF be able to join the new army under a different name and structure, but in basically three blocks that will be divisions of the new army that will be active in the Northeast, as well as, I believe, two or three special units that might include the anti-terrorism forces, which are sort of the elite SDF units that have been engaged in the kind of very high level counter ISIS operations. And the YPJ, or the Women's Defense Units, is also in consideration to get its special status as well, which is something that is, you know, certainly not taken for granted in the negotiations when you look at the composition of the new state. So this has been very positive. It's been a longstanding demand from the Northeast Syria side to have the SDF able to integrate in a way where it keeps its structure and where, critically, people from Northeast Syria are responsible for security in Northeast Syria, right? Where we don't see these Turkish-backed militias, these foreign jihadists, you know, these other unsavory characters that make up much of the new state's army, you know, entering into areas where there are Kurdish populations. So this has been very positive. And I think we see today that in the aftermath of the meeting between Ahmed al-Shara, or Jolani, the new leader of Syria, former leader of HTS, and America's very own Donald Trump in the White House, it does not look like the U.S. is giving a green light for further conflict. And if we look at the sort of strategy that the US has been pursuing here, of, you know, taking Syria, a longstanding Russian ally, and trying to take this change in government as an opportunity to bring it over to the US camp, and at the same time seeing it as very much an investment opportunity, not just for the United States, but specifically for the US president and the people around him. In order to do that, if we think about this from a very, you know, pragmatic perspective and, you know, kind of unfortunately take the morality out of it, they cannot invest and they cannot build a government that will be aligned with them if there is renewed civil war in Syria. Because again, this is not a conflict that either side is capable of winning. And we know that if conflict does resume, we'll see regional states like Turkey and Israel grabbing up Syrian territory for themselves, as they've been doing, you know, at previous stages in the war. We will see other regional and global powers, you know, attempting to, you know, regain some kind of status in Syria. It would be very quickly internationalized, any further conflict, if it were to break out. And it would also scare away really any hope of investment and economic recovery, which is something that the new state has prioritized, you know, particularly looking at their efforts on sanctions relief and things like that. So I think it's important to recognize that, again, there isn't an interest in the Northeast Syria issue being securitized and resolved by military means. And I think the positive messaging that's coming out of Northeast Syria right now about this meeting shows that, you know, even with this renewed international engagement with the new Syrian state, that there's a view that negotiations are going to proceed positively, because it is not in the interest of any party for the transitional government to try and fail to take over the Northeast, and for further, you know, destabilizing ethnic sectarian violence to be perpetrated by government forces. So overall, I think, you know, this is a point in negotiations where it's time for, we might be looking at, you know, actual changes on the ground. And there are still many unresolved questions. I think it's important, you know, we've been talking a lot about security integration here, and the framework for security integration that's been floated is very positive in favor of the SDF and the Northeast, you know, in giving them the presence in and control over security in, you know, the areas where Kurdish communities live, and also influence, you know, in the military and state structure of Syria as a whole. But these discussions haven't really touched on political integration. And while obviously, you know, community control of security and the prevention of the entrance of HTS forces, SNA forces into the Northeast is a very important sort of prerequisite for any kind of self-governance, it's not the end of the story. And here, there are some very significant differences between the Northeast and the transitional government. And this is something, you know, if anybody wants to look at the analysis that Arthur shared in the chat, that would be wonderful. But just on the level of the sort of basic political documents of both sides, for example, the Syrian Constitutional Declaration, as I said, recognizes only Arabic as an official language. In Northeast Syria, you have Kurdish, Arabic, and Aramaic as official languages, and further recognition of every language spoken by communities in Northeast Syria as a language that can be used in official business, and in particular, that can be used as a language of education. So all children, you know, have the ability to go to school in the language that they speak at home, which is critical for language development and, you know, for the rights of those kids and being able to learn in a language that they understand. In Northeast Syria, there's no establishment of religion. There's a very strong commitment to freedom of religion and religious diversity. You know, you had for the first time in Syrian history, for example, the Yazidi community being recognized as its own community in Northeast Syria under their social contract, Previously, under the old Syrian state, Yazidis were considered to be Muslims, which you know, is erasure of their identity. And the jihadist groups that have made up a large portion of the opposition viewed Yazidis, because of their religious minority status, very negatively, persecuted them. And of course, we all know about the genocide committed by the Yazidis of Sinjar by ISIS. So this recognition and protection in Northeast Syria was something very unique. In the transitional government constitutional declaration, they establish religious tests for office. So they say that the president of Syria has to be a Muslim, which, of course, it's a Muslim majority country. You might argue it's very likely that the president of Syria will probably be a Muslim. But when you set the precedent of establishing a religious test for a public office, you're automatically granting one religious group status and prestige over others. And even more concerningly, it establishes Islamic law as the basis of, all jurisprudence in Syria itself, which again is common in the region. But when we see, laws like this implemented, it almost always leads to discrimination, both legally and socially, against non-Muslim religious minorities. So religious freedom is another huge difference. The rights of women, related to the religious freedom issue as well. HTS, when they governed Idlib, imposed a very conservative framing of Islamic law on local populations in a way that led to, sort of religiously justified oppression of women. And then the Syrian state itself, and I think it's very important to understand that there's been a lot of continuity in the type of state that Syria is, was also very oppressive of women and, had very few women, in positions of actual power. So when you have this sort of authoritarian nationalist and Islamist convergence, you have a constitution that goes out of its way to not mention equality for women, instead talking about, their special status within the family and society, which is, language that's very often used to make that status second class. In Northeast Syria, I don't have to tell people here listening, women have achieved an incredibly high level of participation in politics, in self-defense, in public life. Their social contract explicitly mentions, the equality of women in all spheres of public and private life completely. So both, within the public institutions of the autonomous administration, but there's also a constitutional guarantee to equality, within families and communities, which is very important as well. So when we look at these kinds of differences, we see that these gaps are very difficult to bridge because people who are used to equality for women, religious freedom, the ability to speak their own language, aren't really interested in compromising and giving that up, right? There's no 50% or, 66.6%, whatever, 2/3 of the right to speak my language or the right to be an equal citizen as a woman. So these are some very serious divergences here. And the ideal way to resolve them, which would be some form of, community control of local government decentralization, is also a real sticking point in negotiations. Obviously, Northeast Syria is advocating for a decentralized Syria where, cities, towns, municipalities, regions within the country have control over their own security and over their own governance, in a way that puts as much power in the hands of local people as possible. And Damascus, I think it's important to remember, again, the continuity here. Syria has always been, a very centralized state, as a legacy of both British, French colonialism, European colonialism in the region, and a legacy of the kind of ultra hardline Arab nationalist politics of the Ba'ath Party. And it's in a neighborhood of very centralized states as well, again, owing to, those colonial roots and to the nature of the sort of hegemonic regional politics. And then HTS itself, this group that became the transitional government, coming from, origins as a jihadist group, This is also not a group that tolerates any kind of, you know, decentralized rule or sort of pluralism at all. So when these two legacies of the type of state that Syria is and the type of group that HTS was merge, you have a sort of allergy to decentralization and to the idea that communities can organize themselves and determine their own destiny. But at the same time, there's an important contradiction here that is, you know, shaping many of the dynamics of negotiations. The transitional government, as I've repeated here, understands that it cannot, it does not have the military capability, it does not have the economic capability, it does not have the personnel. It cannot take over the entire Northeast and force it under the control of a centralized state in Damascus of its own accord. You know, it's important to recognize here, the transitional government does not fully control, you know, all of the territory that is sort of shaded in green on the map, right? And then when you look at the territory that they don't yet have any control over at all, they simply don't have the capacity to put that under an ultra-centralized system to the degree that they would like. And they're aware of this. I think, you know, this is important to note. The obstacle to the acceptance of a decentralized system, which would sort of solve both sides' problems, right? You know, Damascus doesn't have to cough up the money and personnel to take everything over. People in the Northeast don't have to be ruled by political systems and groups that, you know, view them extremely adversarially. This could work for everyone, but from what we've been hearing, you know, from my contacts with people on the ground here, is that the main obstacle has been Turkey. Turkey does not want to accept a decentralized system in Syria because it fears having to make those same kind of reforms at home. And so when I get into this last part of this introduction here, I think, you know, this is a good segue into the political process in Turkey. As I mentioned, just over a year ago, we learned that renewed peace talks had begun between the PKK and the Turkish state. This is just the latest of many peace attempts since the 1990s when Abdullah Öcalan declared the PKK's first ceasefire. All of these peace processes have attempted to achieve the same thing, which is, you know, Kurdish rights recognition and democratic political participation, you know, within the existing borders of Turkey itself. And, you know, I think when people have been looking at this peace process, there's been a lot of concern. There's been a lot of fear that, you know, too many concessions are being made too early. And I think that if you look at history and you see, you know, the positions the Kurdish movement has taken, this idea that they're willing to accept, you know, one democratic state, you know, with the equal rights for Turkish people and Kurdish people, this is not new. This is something that Öcalan has been saying he's been willing to accept in negotiations since 1993. And even steps that have been taken subsequently, I believe everyone, you know, is familiar with Öcalan's statement in February of this year calling for the disarmament and dissolution of the PKK. The PKK has dissolved itself before. It ended up refounding itself in 2004 and 2005 after the failure of the Turkish state to take steps towards, you know, actually engaging in political reforms. But it has in the past dissolved itself in order to facilitate a political process. So this is not new either. This process of change within the organization is something that's happened many times over. And the willingness to abandon armed struggle as a tactic and engage in political struggle, again, this is something that's been floated in negotiations many, many times over. And I think we have to recognize that even, you know, at this state today, where, you know, the PKK, though having dissolved itself, you know, still does exist organizationally, you know, has not begun the process of disarmament yet, it still is an organization that has many more civilian members than armed members and engages in unarmed politics, you know, to a degree equivalent to or even more significant than the degree to which it is engaged in an active armed conflict. Particularly when you look at the type of armed conflict that was being fought, you know, for the past 20 years or so, the PKK has not been fighting for the control of territory. Obviously, in Iraq and Syria against ISIS, that was a bit of a different situation. You know, they had the opportunity to take hold and govern territory. But the war within Turkey's borders, you know, the conflict that is actually being ended right now, was being fought for the purpose of gaining political leverage in order to, you know, impose conditions where gains could be made through negotiations or through other forms of politics. And I think the organization reached a point where, you know, they decided that it was actually better for the political side of the Kurdish movement, you know, that is engaged in legal politics through parliaments and municipalities, that is engaged in, you know, politics sort of outside of formal legal structures through community organizing, you know, at the neighborhood level, at the city level, you know, in all the areas where Kurds live in Turkey, that these aspects of the movement would actually be stronger in an environment where there was not an armed conflict between the PKK and the government of Turkey on Turkish soil. So I think we have to remember here when we're looking at what the Kurdish movement has done over this past year, that these are not necessarily things it has not done before and been able to come back from, you know, that there's a history here. And also that the armed conflict within Turkey is only one part of an armed and political struggle, you know, that has been taking place across the Middle East in different capacities. And it's very important, you know, I think, to recognize that this is only talking about Turkey. You know, Turkish officials have said that Öcalan should call on the SDF to disband itself, that Kurds in Iran, you know, inspired by Öcalan's ideas and the branch of the movement there, PJAK, should disarm. And Öcalan and the Kurdish movement have been very clear that these statements do not apply to other parts of Kurdistan. You know, that the SDF is engaged in its own process, not to disarm, but to be the armed force, you know, of Syria in the regions of northeast Syria where Kurds live, and that Iran is a different situation, you know, altogether, entirely. So that's important to recognize, I think. And in these negotiations, we've seen positive indicators, though, again, we haven't gotten to the point of full legal and institutional changes. You know, compared to a year ago, Öcalan is now able himself, you know, to communicate and engage in negotiations. Different parts of the movement are able to communicate and talk to each other in a way that they couldn't before. There have been no removals and replacements of Kurdish elected officials since Öcalan's statement in February of last year. So while they have not restored elected officials to their positions, they have stopped removing them from office. And in the past few weeks, we've also seen releases of Kurdish mayors from prison. You know, we've seen cases dropped against Kurdish elected officials. And critically, we've seen developments in the case of Selahattin Demirtas, who's arguably, you know, the most famous political prisoner from the legal side of Kurdish politics, that could lead to his release under the European Court of Human Rights decisions. So there have been improvements for, you know, the kind of political environment for Kurdish parties. There have been many releases of political prisoners who, you know, served decades in Turkish prisons, who are now, you know, actually being let out. You know, laws are being implemented that had previously, you know, the state had been violating in order to keep people in prison for a very long time. There is increased political capacity, you know, for Kurdish parties in Turkey right now that is very important. And then critically, there is a ceasefire. We see this in northeast Syria right now. You know, it is now safe in Qamishlo to go outside. People are not worried about, you know, drone strikes on civilian infrastructure, on, you know, people engaged in politics and self-defense in these areas. You know, people are able to move around freely in a way that they haven't been for years. The ceasefire is also in place in Iraqi Kurdistan as well. There's been record low levels of military activity. Again, the drone strikes are not as much of a problem. So we've seen these improvements. But again, like in Syria, we're at a stage where it has to get to the point of actual changes being made. And the kind of changes that are being looked at in Turkey include things like a legal framework for PKK members to come down from the mountains and, you know, reintegrate and participate in politics in Turkey. I think a lot of times, you know, people are saying, oh, well, typically in peace processes, disarmament is the last stage. But it's important to note that in many of these peace processes that sort of form the model, the armed movement doesn't have a political party. The Kurdish movement in Turkey has Turkey's second largest opposition party, right? You know, the Dem Party, that pro-Kurdish political tradition, already exists and already has significant political power, you know, that can really only be increased, I think, in this process. So there exists a framework into which people who are shifting away from armed struggle can, they don't have to found their own political party, they can move into an established political tradition. So I think that is something that makes this process different, you know, that's important to recognize. And then, of course, on the horizon in Turkey are potential changes to the constitution where, you know, of course, obviously Erdogan wants to adjust the constitution to allow himself to run for president again, but he doesn't have enough votes to do that with his party, the AKP, and his allies, the MHP. He needs Kurdish votes, and it is really impossible to have the Dem Party, you know, the pro-Kurdish political movement, voting for a new constitution that doesn't make serious changes on Kurdish rights. So that is something that is on the table now as well. And I think I can end it here. You know, I feel like I've given a good overview of where we are in negotiations. You know, as a bottom line, the situation right now is not bad. There is stability. There is not active armed conflict. The Kurdish position in negotiations in both countries is strong. And we can expect to see, I think, some actual, you know, critical developments in these processes in the coming weeks and months. How the process has been conducted is, on one level, in some ways necessary for it to move forward. But on another level, it really does create a lot of uncertainty and concern, you know, among the communities that are on the ground living through this, engaged in this. So that contradiction, you know, really has been very important to understanding kind of how the process has moved forward. And I think, you know, has created a lot of very legitimate, you know, concerns and questions among, you know, the communities engaged here. So it is important to address that. I think that the difference between integration and assimilation or capitulation is something that the Kurdish movement's ideas of democratic confederalism have addressed for a while. Because, you know, as you said, and as we all know, you know, if you're here on this call, it is a movement that is against this concept of the nation state. But the way that it tries to go about that is not by creating new borders or, you know, changing necessarily those existing political formats. It's by overcoming the nation state, you know, in the actual context on the ground of the communities where Kurds live. And now, what does overcoming the nation state looks like? It means that on one level, you try to transform the state, you know, so it is not an obstacle against you, so that it is more democratic, so that there is political space, so that the people responsible for security where you are not people who are opposed to your existence, all of these things. And then at the same time, you strengthen society, you know, community organizations, people's own level of engagement in everything from, you know, legal politics to community organizing outside of state structures, to a degree where, you know, people are able to solve their problems and, you know, determine their future, regardless of kind of what the policy of the central government is doing. And so these two processes in parallel, you know, create a situation where at the same time, you might have these existing borders of Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria, but ideally where Kurdish communities within those borders, you know, have organized themselves and, you know, gained enough political freedom where those sort of structures aren't such impositions on their lives anymore. And I think that We can see examples of this in, you know, the political organizing of the Kurdish movement in northern Kurdistan, you know, within Turkey, where if you look during the last peace process, you know, throughout the 2000s and 2010s, they created a level of political organization, you know, when given the opportunity to by previous peace negotiations. They were able to build up both their capacity to engage, you know, in legal politics within the Turkish system, but also the capacity to organize themselves and take advantage of, you know, the sort of freedom and breathing space provided by their participation in that system. So in an HDP municipality, for example, you would on the one hand have, you know, the elected mayor, the elected city council, which was a pro-Kurdish party, you know, engaged in contesting electoral politics, you know, within the limits of democracy, quote unquote, in Turkey. But because you had that, you had more space to then also have things like women's councils, councils of peoples and beliefs, you know, bringing different religious communities together, community organizing that wasn't a part of the municipal structure of the state of Turkey, but that had space to exist because of, you know, a certain level of democratic, you know, political participation. And that in turn, you know, created the actual social base from which that legal political participation, formal political participation could then exist. So you saw these two processes sort of working at the same time of trying to ease up state pressure and take advantages of opportunities there, you know, insofar as that could be done, while also building community capacity. And I think that something like this is what Kurds and, you know, the communities in Northeast Syria are looking for to an even more developed degree, because politically the conditions in Northeast Syria are better than, you know, conditions in Turkey for Kurds ever were. If we look at how integration is going to kind of keep revolutionary institutions alive, when, for example, the SDF merges into the army of the new Syrian state, on the one hand, that certainly is in many ways, you know, a departure from and an ending of a certain phase of history where this was a, you know, non-state community-based armed force, you know, engaged in the defense, you know, of the very communities that it came from. But at the same time, it means that the people providing security in Kobani or Kamishlo or Derik will be people from those cities who have the politics and the social views and the perspectives of the people who live there. You know, it will mean that because they're now responsible for, you know, being the Syrian state forces that are providing security, that means that Syrian state forces aren't going to go around, you know, disrupting community meetings or telling people that they can't speak Kurdish, you know, asking women why they're walking by themselves on the street, right? So you have allowed the state to come back. You have allowed the state to absorb, you know, what was previously a revolutionary institution. But at the same time, if that institution is now sort of the representative of the state, of the government in that area, it means that the government is going to largely keep its hands off of, you know, people's organizing and participation, right? You know, if the autonomous administration institutions are integrated with state institutions, you know, that could look very different from the type of state institutions that Syria has had in the past. You know, decentralization, it's a difficult conversation, but it is something that's on the table. We could see administrative divisions and, you know, the powers of local government being very different. And what communities in Northeast Syria could do in that type of structure would be something similar to what the HDP, the Dem Party now, has done in Turkey. If you hold the offices, you know, if you control the politics, you can make sure that those politics, you know, are not harming your community. You know, you can then create space for other organizing to continue. You know, I think one really interesting example of this can be found in how the women's movement is approaching a lot of these questions. You have, on the one hand, you know, they've made their red lines and talks very clear. You know, they want the YPJ to continue to exist in some form, you know, to have a women's autonomous armed force, they're defending, you know, women's equal participation. They're defending the co-chair system. They're defending equal rights for women, you know, at the level of the Constitution. But at the same time, you know, when you ask many women leaders here how they feel about integration, they're like, we were doing the work that we're doing for the freedom of women before we were ever a part of any government. And we will keep doing it, you know, no longer, you know, no matter who is the government here. You know, they point out that for something like the women's movement, there's even an asset to not being, you know, a formal part of the state, because it allows you to be more critical of the system overall. You know, there's a level of flexibility there. And, you know, returning to the origins, you know, as a movement kind of outside of the system that doesn't have to deal with some of the contradictions that happen when you go into, you know, formal security and governance. So I think overall, this idea that, you know, it's integration, you know, in the sense of taking some of the power away from the central government and holding onto it yourself, and not, you know, capitulation to the central government. You know, I think it's important to understand that, you know, that is really what people are fighting for, and that is a feasible outcome for them to get. You know, again, the transitional government does not have the capacity to force capitulation on Northeast Syria. The only way that they could do it is if they got Turkey to go along with a military operation. And if you look at the political dynamics in Turkey, they have been invested in the peace process. They have their own reasons for not wanting to do that. You know, that would destabilize the entire political process that has been taking place and lead to, I think, a very damaging level of conflict. So it's never for certain, but I do think that they can't count any longer on, you know, the inevitability of that kind of military escalation as a tool against the Kurds. So, you know, there's not, the transitional government doesn't at this point have the capacity to, and likely will not have the capacity to, force Northeast Syria to give up everything. And while it is a real concession, and it is a real, I think, you know, something that people can be concerned about, to have these institutions become part of the state, the way in which I think they aim to do so is in the sense that, you know, they will be able to then take the pressure of the state off of the people of Northeast Syria and allow those communities to, you know, govern and defend themselves to the highest degree possible. So, and then of course you have, like we've been discussing before, things like, you know, equal constitutional rights, language rights, religious freedom. People are not going to give that up. You know, that is not up for negotiation. Integration also means that you, a Kurdish citizen of Syria, have all of the same rights as a Sunni Arab citizen of Syria, right? So that equal citizenship, you know, equal participation, that is a basic condition of all of these negotiations. You know, that has been made very clear by the SDF and the Autonomous Administration. So yeah, I think that's how we can understand kind of this question here. I think, you know, typically when people are referring to, you know, US support for the Kurds, they're talking about the assistance to the SDF for the counter-ISIS mission. You know, we remember October 2019, we've seen that that doesn't always actually translate into support. But in terms of the security assistance, that is continuing. You know, the latest congressional budget for 2026 does include, you know, ongoing support to the SDF. And the US, I think, for the ulterior motives that I mentioned of trying to take Syria out of the Russian-Iranian alignment, you know, bring it on to a U.S. alignment, and the sort of personal interests of U.S. leaders in investment in Syria, and the interests, you know, of their allies in the Gulf, you know, in, you know, Arab states in the region, those interests need some level of stability and peace in order to take place. You know, there's not a company that's going to start building, you know, big projects in Damascus or Aleppo if they believe that the Syrian civil war is going to restart tomorrow. So for reasons that are very different from the reasons why we might want to see a successful, you know, peaceful integration. I think that the US and other coalition countries also want to see a successful, peaceful integration, because they know what the SDF knows and what the SDG knows, which is that a military conflict, you know, aimed at recapturing the Northeast and forcing it back under Damascus's control would not actually lead to a restoration of, you know, traditional centralized Syrian sovereignty, but would restart the civil war, give Turkey an opportunity to move in, give Israel an opportunity to move in, let the Russians and the Iranians, you know, try to fight for their place back, you know, really cause a lot of not just, you know, chaos and suffering within Syria, but return to the sort of internationalized, protracted regional conflict that had been taking place before the fall of the regime. And I think that there are many interests, you know, in avoiding that outcome, you know, from the U.S., from the part of the Europeans, the Gulf, you know. The only players that I think see something to be won in more conflict in Syria are the Israelis and, to a lesser extent, the Turks. We've seen Turkey backing off because of the process, you know, with the Kurdish movement. They've not abandoned their military presence in Syria, and they've certainly not abandoned, you know, the level of influence that they have over the Syrian state. You know, that influence has stretched to a point where you even hear, you know, reporting of Syrian leaders being kind of feeling restricted by, you know, Turkey's approach. But they have not tried to take more territory. They have not, you know, been engaged in active conflict with the SDF since the ceasefire. And then leading into the second question, Israel, you know, I think in, as a state, you know, they have seen that, you know, their escalation and aggression in the region, you know, has weakened Iran. They're looking for a path to being sort of the hegemonic power in the region, you know, similar to what Turkey is also looking for. They do not want to see any kind of, you know, functioning states kind of on their periphery, because that inhibits their ability to expand in the region and kind of project their own power. So they have an interest in chaos in Syria. You know, I think we see this in their approach to the previous Syrian state. We see this in their approach to the current Syrian state. They do not benefit from necessarily a situation where conflict in Syria has ended and where there is a sort of strong functioning country of Syria that is on their border. And that is, you know, dangerous to some degree, obviously, because, you know, any kind of further, you know, military escalation could precipitate conflict. There's been a lot of reporting of, you know, the threats to Syrian communities, you know, in the territory that Israel has moved into. At the same time, you know, the sort of competition between Israel, Turkey, and Iran in the region, when you have a multipolar system, when you have multiple states that are competing for hegemony, this, while it does make things very dangerous and unpredictable, it also creates opportunities, because, you know, when these states feel as though their interests are threatened, they may feel as though they have to make new political agreements. We see this with Turkey's engagement in the peace process, right? You know, Turkey is concerned that in the event of conflict in the Middle East, that Israel or Iran might choose to support Kurds against Turkey. A lot of this is conspiracy theories, and obviously the Kurdish movement has its very significant differences with the type of systems that exist in Israel and Iran. But because of this competition, Turkey feels like it wants to get the Kurdish movement on side, so to speak. And so while this creates threats, it also does create opportunities at the same time. I think that overall, the approach that Syria is trying to take at this point, you know, is to not pick fights with neighboring countries. Similarly, you know, in terms of trying to establish like some level of internal security, they don't want to, I think, you know, they're looking at engaging, you know, with as many of these governments as possible. You know, they've been talking to Russia, they've been talking to Iran, they've been talking to Israel. And, you know, any level of diplomatic engagement with Syria, you know, we're going to see can strengthen the transitional government's position. But at the same time, you know, the more countries that want to engage, I think that the SDF has seen Syria's engagement, you know, with all of these regional countries as preferable to renewed civil war. So the SDF certainly doesn't want to see a situation where Israel attacks Syria, you know, where Turkey attacks Syria, where Iran or Russia tries to do something. The view here, you know, people are tired. That's also very important. No one wants to see more fighting. There's not public appetite for it either. And I think that's something that decision makers on all sides are thinking about as well. Yeah, that's a very important question. I think this is something that, again, you know, we hear a lot of critique of the autonomous administration for, that, you know, in all of these years of building an education system, there wasn't necessarily enough importance placed on getting that system recognized internationally. And while, you know, it is important to note that there are a lot of opportunities internally within Northeast Syria for people who graduate from the local school system, yes, they can't take those degrees outside of Northeast Syria. And that is a real issue, you know, that is very impactful on people's lives. Everyone wants their degree to be recognized. So I think that the administration could have and should have taken the accreditation issue more seriously. And some of the, I think, you know, diaspora and foreign academics, you know, who helped with that system didn't always put as much importance on that and didn't always necessarily use the connections that they had to make that a priority in the way that they could have either. And, you know, this is a long discussion, but I think that that's a real criticism that does come up and that people are talking about here. The only way for it to be recognized is for, you know, in this process of integration, for the government to grant recognition. And that is something that the autonomous administration is asking for. You know, it's my understanding that any decentralization deal, they're going to demand, obviously, you know, education in, you know, students' first languages, you know, allowing schools to operate in Kurdish and other, you know, non-Arabic languages spoken in Syria. They're going to try to keep, you know, the universities that they have established. And this will take technical expertise. This will take time. But it's ultimately a political question. And the way that this resolves now, you know, for all of the criticisms that you can make of the past, is that, you know, they're going to go to the negotiating table. They're going to ask for that recognition. And I think that it's very reasonable to expect that as part of any kind of deal, you know, that will be something that the government will offer. Yeah, so first of all, this is definitely coming up in negotiations. This is important for the administration. They were supposed to establish, I think, you know, joint committees from both the transitional government and the autonomous administration to specifically address this issue. The March 10th agreement on, you know, sort of outlining the integration deal does explicitly mention the return of all displaced Syrians to their homes. There hasn't been much progress. I don't believe that those committees were ever set up. But I know that this is something that, you know, leaders have said is very important, and that does come up when they are engaging with their counterparts in the transitional government. There have been some positive developments in that people from Afrin have been able to start returning to their homes. I personally know, you know, many people from Afrin whose families have gone back to check on their houses and properties. Right now is the olive harvest season, so a lot of people are going back to check on their olive groves, you know, harvest the olives. And many of the people who were moved in by Turkey, you know, in order to change demographics, displaced people from other parts of Syria, and even refugees from Turkey who were actually illegally deported from Turkey into Afrin, you know, for the purpose of changing the region's demographics and kind of fulfilling the government's sort of xenophobic, you know, promises on sending Syrian refugees back. These people can now go back to the parts of Syria that they are actually from. You know, since the fall of the regime, a lot of them have chosen to do that. which has created space for the original residents of Afrin to then, you know, be able to return to their homes. And there are a lot of security challenges. You know, people are coming back to houses. One thing that apparently has been going on is that when, you know, these people who were moved in there after the occupation, when they leave, they've been stealing the windows and doors out of people's houses. Like, I don't know, you know, what needs to go through your head, what situation you have to be in to be like, okay, I've been living in this stolen house. Now I can go back to my house. Let me steal the window. Like, what? You know, it's just, it boggles the mind. So people are coming back and finding, you know, properties in condition that is not really livable. There are still, you know, Turkish-backed armed groups that have now been nominally integrated under the Ministry of Defense, but that retain their own command structures and really don't have any mechanism for accountability, that are still harassing Afrin residents, you know, imposing fines and taxes and, you know, essentially demanding money from civilians for all types of purposes. I know people who've gone back to visit their olive groves and, you know, start harvesting olives, who found that armed groups have taken some portion of their fields. And the level of accountability is, from what I've been hearing, essentially dependent on who the individual from the transitional government that you're talking to is. You know, I heard one story of a family from Afrin who actually got a call from a member of the HTS General Security that, hey, someone's leaving your village and it looks like they're taking a bunch of the stuff out of your house. Now, they didn't arrest the person who was stealing from the house, but they had the courtesy to be like, hey, you know, maybe if you have relatives in the village, get them over there to like look at that and stop that, right? You know, so there are some people who will try to help in some way, but then there are also people who do nothing. There are people who, you know, allow these groups to continue to behave in a very damaging way. And, you know, I think it's worth noting that the situation under the Turkish occupation was so bad that when people heard that it was HTS that was going to come in and replace the Turkish-backed Syrian National Army SNA groups, there was actually a level of optimism, because the view was that while HTS were radical Islamists, at least they had a sense of law and order. You know, they weren't randomly breaking into people's